Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Denise Ho was one of the biggest pop stars in China. She played stadiums, she was in movies, she advertised brands like Motorola and Yves Saint Laurent all over Asia.
Denise Ho is a singer of cantopop, which means that she performs in the Chinese dialect of Cantonese. At her peak, she was one of the top-selling female artists in Hong Kong and played all over mainland China and Taiwan, basically any countries with a large Chinese emigre population.
That's staff writer Jiang Fan, who recently profiled Denise Ho.
And then 2014 rolls around, and students and activists took to the streets to ask for a more democratic process, and Denise joined them in their fight for universal suffrage. The protests, which sprung up in various neighborhoods throughout Hong Kong, became known as the Umbrella Movement. And the umbrella was a powerful symbol because it was a tool that protesters used to defend themselves against the tear gas that police officers were spraying on them. Denise was arrested on national television and became an enduring image of the struggle for democracy. Before the Umbrella Movement, Denise Ho was earning about 80% of her income from mainland China, where she is now prohibited from performing and where her music has been completely scrubbed from the internet.
Now Denise Ho is trying to reinvent herself as something like a countercultural songwriter, all under the very watchful eye of the Chinese government. Here's Jiang Fan speaking with Denise Ho.
So you grew up in Hong Kong and you moved to Montreal at age 11.
Right.
And then you moved back to Hong Kong to pursue your singing career. Did being away from Hong Kong for almost 10 years make you see Hong Kong differently by the time you came back at age 19 or 20?
Well, it was kind of, you know, a dream that I had, I guess, during the teenage years to, you know, maybe someday go back to Hong Kong because...
Why was it important to you to go back to Hong Kong? Why did you harbor this dream?
Well, I didn't see myself singing, you know, besides Celine Dion or, you know, in French. Or I didn't see myself having a career in Canada. And so I was really updated with what was happening in the music and entertainment industry in Hong Kong. My idol is this cantopop diva, Anita Mui. And she was some sort of a link between me and Hong Kong, I guess, you know, during all those years that I wasn't in Hong Kong. She was this very, very extravagant singer with all, you know, these costumes and she was amazing on stage. She had this showmanship that was incomparable to anybody else in Hong Kong, or even in the Asian, you know, in the Asian market, and that was what attracted me first. She was very socially aware. She took a responsibility to voice out her opinions whenever she saw something that she had to stand up for. Namely, you know, when in 1989, the Tiananmen
massacre.
Yeah, she was very in the very, very front of the whole movement.
Right,
that was something that I admired. And also that influenced me a lot without me knowing, you know, unconsciously.
Cantonese pop songs and Cantonese singing celebrities are known to be very beautiful, very glamorous. Mm-hmm. And many of their most popular tunes are catchy and sometimes thought of as formulaic and quite saturated, but your songs have encompassed a much larger range of issues, everything from the lives of marginalized to even mental illness. I mean, you have this album called 10 Days
in the madhouse.
Why did you want to explore these subjects that are sometimes considered ugly? Why was that important to you?
The whole journey started when I became 30, which was 11 years ago. And, you know, I had a great, according to me, I had a great career until then, you know, awards and all that. I was starting to get onto that path of thinking, is that all? You know, is that all that I can do with my songs, my career? You know, just for personal wealth and all that. And so, yeah, that was when I started to think, you know, should I be doing more? You know, I just went to San Francisco last week, and I was really shocked when there were so many homeless people, and I guess some of them were, you know, they had certain mental illness, and you know, they are just the taboo of every city. And so back then I wanted to do this album talking about madness.
Growing up, I mean, did you have any personal connection to, you know, either depression or anxiety? Or did you have friends who experienced any kind?
Actually, no.
Wow.
No.
Was there a song in 10 Days in the Madhouse that particularly stood out to you, or that, you know, is your favorite, you know?
Yeah. Well, the first song, which is Qingshan Daima, Thelma.
Uh-huh.
And it's about this girl who enters this madhouse, which for her is, you know, the society where there are so many different issues that seems very sickening to her. I think there is this part of the lyrics which is talking about, you know, people think that they are so strong and so normal and, you know, better than everyone else, but you know, it's just basically everyone is quite lost, you know, in their everyday lives. In that project, we went to interview so many different people, and I interviewed this doctor, and he said, you know, Hong Kong society is actually the biggest asylum.
Wow.
Is. Yeah, because there are so many issues and problems that we just bury and hide and drawers and all that, but like it's so, yeah, there are sicknesses everywhere.
In Chinese society, again, there's such value placed on decorum and your behavior and hiding things that you're not proud of or you think that society would not be proud of.
Yeah.
And that really segues, I think, nicely to what must have been a great difficulty in being a celebrity with a secret. Because you were the first major female celebrity to come out as a lesbian. And how old were you when you came out publicly?
35. Yeah, in 2012.
Right. And I know a good friend of yours, Anthony Wong, who's also a singer, had to come out. And it was, you know, all anybody could talk about it, you know, when that happened. What was coming out like for you? You know, how did you decide to finally do it?
Well, to be honest, it wasn't a secret, you know. You know, people,
it was an open secret.
They knew. Mm-hmm. You know, I had all these songs, you know, talking about gender, love and gender issues. And which one of them was, you know, quite a success, you know, in the very mainstream pop culture.
Rolls Royce, right?
Yeah, yeah. All my friends knew, and
your family knew as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, my family knew, and even my fans, they were, you know, they were probably 99.9% sure
right.
of that fact.
By and large, I think the response was positive, right? I mean, you tell me how did the fans react?
Well, surprisingly, Beijing was fine with it.
Right.
You know, you just felt, you know, brands just observing.
Right. You know, they're very cautious.
They didn't ban you or anything, but they were very cautious.
Mm-hmm.
And, but nothing, you know, from the Chinese government, they didn't say anything.
Mm.
And so it was, you know, it was good days.
And then 2014 rolls around,
yep.
And it's the umbrella movement. And it really stirred up a lot of tensions in society just about the political fate of Hong Kong.
Right.
And you were arrested on national TV, and you were, I think, you know, the biggest celebrity to be arrested on national TV. How did that day unfold for you?
Yeah, there was this very big protest for Hong Kong to have the right to vote, you know, for our own chief executive officer,
right.
Which is, you know, promised to us in the basic law. It was written. We had the slogan that we 我要真普选, which is, you know, we want universal suffrage.
Uh-huh.
And so the crowds, they started to gather all the public. It wasn't just, you know, the activists and the students.
Like, right.
And so I decided to you know, be one of the people representing this group of adults, and me and one or two others.
Were you aware of the tremendous risk that you were taking and how much it would cost your career and your livelihood? Was that something that you thought about beforehand?
Yes. Well, I was aware, I guess, partially of what might happen. The government, you know, they didn't listen, but we didn't think that they were that unreasonable, you know. And we didn't feel that, you know, what happened afterwards, where, you know, students got jailed.
How long did you spend in jail?
It was just like 12 hours.
Mm.
Yeah. It wasn't officially, you know, I wasn't officially in jail. We were just detained.
Right.
Yeah.
And afterwards, you said, you know, you partially expected and partially didn't expect. What was the most surprising to you in terms of the fallout, in terms of what you didn't expect?
Well, I expected my career to have, you know, changes to it. And I expected to be banned from China. But I wasn't expecting, you know, the fact that the government would react in such a way where the main goal is to silence,
of course,
everyone, and to silence you know, especially the younger generations with fear. You know,
so much of your art is about bringing your music to an audience, but in the wake of this political stance that you were so brave to take, you've been banned from reaching the masses in mainland China.
Yeah.
And there's just a contradiction there. I mean, so much of what you want to give to the world is your music, but because of politics, you are cut off from reaching, you know, 1.4 billion people. How do you reconcile yourself with that particular reality?
Yeah, being cut off, to be very honest, I guess that is the only thing, you know, if you ask, is there anything bad coming out from this whole incident, is getting the message to these people. But still, there are chances for me, you know, as long as I am creative and I have my imagination, I can still get through to people, I can still get by.
The New Yorker's Jiang Fan speaking with Denise Ho, who was in Hong Kong.